This is Brain Inspired, powered by The Transmitter. Hey everyone, it's Paul. This is the first of two less usual episodes. I was recently in Norway at a neuro AI workshop called Validating Models, How Would Success in Neuro AI Look Like? And what follows are a few recordings I made with my friend Gaute Einvall. Gaute has been on this podcast before, but more importantly, he started his own podcast a while back called Theoretical Neuroscience, which you should definitely check out. So Gaute and I will introduce these conversations we had with a few of the invited speakers at the workshop and one of the main organizers. I link to everyone's information in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/195. So I hope you enjoy these conversations that we had on a rather large boat you'll hear about in a second. Enjoy. Two podcasters on a boat in Norway.
How can that go wrong? Yeah.
Hi, Gaute.
Hi. Hi, Paul.
Why are we doing this together? What's happening?
Yeah, this is, I mean, you have been making Brain Inspired for how many years?
I think five, maybe six. Yeah.
5-6 years, exactly. So I've been podcasting for 5-6 years, but this new theoretical neuroscience podcast is sort of, that started in October. So, and I remember I talked to Konrad Kording and this Brain Inspired was an inspiration for me to make this what I call academic podcast. Mm. Right? It's not really about, it's actually for people in the community. It's not a popular science podcast, really. It's, which are, of course, really important too, but it's a different thing. So in some sense, when I talked to Konrad Kording about this, he said, oh, so your podcast is Brain Inspired. So that is actually true. That's actually true. So anyway, so we are a little bit, some sense like sister podcast, wouldn't you say? We are sort of both sort of like, I mean, yours are like neuro AI and mine is a little bit more sort of like into the like more other aspects of theoretical neuroscience, maybe like more like starting with the physics tradition, because that's sort of where I come from. Yeah. But anyway, when we both were going to this very nice workshop on neuro AI on the coast of Norway, so then of course we have met before. You visited me in Oslo once. So then we decided, why don't we pool the resources and make a joint podcast.
Yeah. So what came out of it is just a few discussions that we had with some of the invited speakers and then also with one of the organizers, Mikkel, to sort of frame the workshop. So you'll hear from Mikkel a little bit about how this workshop came about. And then in closing, so this will be two episodes. And then at the end of the second episode, which will be our second discussion, Mikkel kind of summarizes and wraps up as well.
So, anyway, so the workshop, just to introduce that a little bit more. So that was then on neuro AI. It was sort of Mikkel Lepperød in Oslo, and I think Konrad Kording, who is sort of like most central in working out the program. But there were also like other organizers who I think sort of supported secured the funding, like people in Oslo, Anders Malte Sørensen, Marianne Fien, and Tone Skramstad. I like to give credit to people.
Of course, they did an awesome job. It was an awesome workshop.
It was an awesome workshop, both. Yeah. So this was quite unique. I mean, I never taken. It was on a coastal liner along the most beautiful coast of Norway, from Tromsø down to Trondheim. It took like 3 days or 2.5 days or something.
Yeah.
And it was a good weather, and it was really, really excellent in all ways. As you mentioned, the first clip we present here is with Mikkel, the main organizer, where we actually discussed with him why he made that podcast and what X wanted to get out with. It was done in the...
You said podcast, you mean workshop.
Workshop, exactly. Sort of like we call it Freudian slip, isn't that something? Yeah. Yeah, so I meant workshop. So, and this was done at the last day of the workshop in a luggage room of a quite fancy hotel in Trondheim, the Britannia Hotel, which is sort of, I used to study in Trondheim. So this was sort of like the, The places you don't go when you are on the student budget, to be sure. But anyway, we're in, it's very fancy. So we're in the luggage room, and so the sound is actually better. But they also had people walking, coming into the luggage room, like our friend John Krakauer, for example, who attended the workshop.
Yep, he makes a boisterous entrance. But it's brief. But he was the main interrupter or whatever. So we say hi to him, and you'll hear other things in the background and other people kind of coming in and out. So
Yeah, and we link to the homepage of the workshop.
So this is divided into two episodes. So in the episode that's going to come out in just a couple days, you'll hear Christina Savin or Savin. I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, and Tim Vogels, and we'll talk a little bit more about them in the next episode. But on this first conversation that we have Andreas Tolias and Ken Harris. Gauta, do you want to talk about Andreas?
Yeah. No, so Andreas Tolias, he has just moved to Stanford, by the way. And he is sort of, at least he's done many things. And he obviously is doing monkey physiology and mouse physiology. Some of the work that I'm particularly interested in is these foundation models he has made for the visual cortex of mice, where he has sort of trained these deep networks to essentially sort of predict sort of calcium responses when the mouse is shown different kind of visual stimuli. And I think in terms of predictability, this is sort of like really the state of the art when it comes to making these kind of models that predict things. And of course, in terms of interpretability, which we also discuss a little bit in the podcast, it's a bit different, and it's harder to interpret. And then there were Ken Harris.
Yeah, so Ken, among other things, I mean, he's interested in, you know, how large populations of neurons sense the world and convert that sensation into action. But one of the things he's been known for in the past few years is just the immense recording capacity. So in the past few years, our data has skyrocketed, the computational power has skyrocketed, and he was, speaking of cutting edge, he was one of the first to use a super high density recording electrode to record thousands of neurons at the same time. And that has not been done before, so we're still grappling with what to do with all these neurons. But that's we don't actually talk so much about their research in these conversations. No.
Because he actually at the workshop, he actually talked about, he had been challenged to talk about sort of actually what it means to understand something more on the like a philosophy of science.
That's right. So, yeah. Okay. So I think that's a fair enough introduction. And all right. So enjoy our discussion and see you in a few days.
Mika, so you had this idea to put this workshop together that we're now at the end of, but we're going to go back to the beginning and ask you how this workshop came about and what was it supposed to be about?
Yeah, so I come from, I had the training in both kind of computational and experimental neuroscience. I've been working the past kind of, I don't know, 4 years. On
neuro-AI models.
It's okay. Yeah.
It's okay.
It's just John Krakauer. It's the number 15 on my podcast. This is the 15th time you'll appear on the podcast.
It has a characteristic laughter, which we have enjoyed all through the workshop.
I hope you meet him.
Yeah, no, I do.
Hey, are you leaving? Are you out?
I'm going to check in.
Okay, cool.
I'll get the dinner. Okay. Sorry.
No,
you're good. So you've been studying computational neuroscience and,
I mean, I got really excited when I learned that we could, when I did my work in my PhD and training, I was working on grid cells and spatial representations in rat brains, foraging.
It's a very Norwegian thing to do.
It is a very Norwegian thing to do, I guess. But I'm always been interested in kind of the why question. Okay, why do we have these representations? What are these cells used for? And my training from mathematics and always drove me into kind of comparing experiments with models. That is kind of how I envisioned science would be for me. And I tried to do that in some of the experimental work I did. I tried to perturb, neurons with optogenetics. I perturbed the medial septum area while recording medial and thoracic cortex and trying to see if I could say something about validating models back then, like the classic computational models of grid cells. So I think this kind of notion of validating models has always been kind of a core part of my vision of how science should be done.
Well, how did the neuro AI thing come in?
I mean, I started working on neuro AI models of grid cells, if you will, or navigation, when there was a model coming out from DeepMind, and also in parallel, there's a paper from Cueva Wei. Yeah. That did a parallel kind of discovery that if you train recurrent neural networks on path integration tasks, so you give them velocity input and you train them to output like a position based on that, then in some models you can see a similar pattern that you see in real brains. So this seemed to be very, and I think it still is, it's a very interesting way of modeling these phenomena, because you don't put that many assumptions in. So in the classical mechanistic models, you kind of build in what you're seeing, and so it's a slightly different approach. So my hope with these models was that you could kind of, without putting in too many assumptions about what the system does, you could, you know, have these patterns emerge or, you know, become part of the computation that the RNN is doing, and then you could probe it afterwards and ask why questions. So what are these cells doing? How are they interacting? And so on and so forth, because that's something you can't do in experiments very easy. But working on these models, I realized it's not that easy. So, you know, you can train a model and you can get, you know, a lot of different results, and you can even, there was a big discussion whether or not this grid pattern would occur kind of consistently. And it doesn't.
You always mean over different training regimes and different architectures and stuff? Or?
Exactly, yeah. Or even just the initialization, at least in the early models.
Yeah.
Looking at that, I, you know, started worrying about, you know, how are we supposed to kind of relate these models back to neuroscience. I mean, that was my motivation, at least. And I think it's the motivation for many that, you know, you can use these models to say something about how the brain works. So
for the workshop, did you think, oh, I need to make some new friends here and have some people to...
one thing is that, I mean, this work kind of sparked the kind of notion in me that, you know, we really need to do this in the right way in order to say something that has a scientific rigor. And we can't just, you know, generate lots of models and, you know, say that every model that has, you know, sufficiently, you know, gritty or whatever pattern you're looking for is a good model. So that's kind of sparked the scientific question. And in terms of the workshop, I think many of these problems are, they would occur in many other systems as well. And looking at the other types of neuro AI models that are being used that are somewhat similar, where you train, you know, you can train a vision model to recognize images, and you can compare their, you know, by linear probing, you can compare their activations with real neurons, or just do this similarity analysis.
Yeah, and lots of different ways to compare the models with the neural activity.
Exactly. So I think in many of those cases, similar problems can occur where you can generate lots of different models. And even though they look similar to what you study in the brain, and they even look similar to between the models, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing the same thing.
Well, even if the output is the same, the way that they're doing it might not be the same.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of this, this algorithmic level question of whether or not they're implementing the same algorithm.
So you gathered together a wide variety of people from different fields using different types of models to study different brain systems, but also using AI as a tool to analyze their data. There's even a philosopher here, one philosopher. Mm. That's enough for any conference, right? So it was a nice group of people. So
it's a fantastic venue you chose.
Oh, like my
this,
God.
Yeah. This, like, this coastline that goes, shows this, like, the coolest thing of Norway is from the nature point of view are the fjords. Mm-hmm. So even in the, remember, in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, this guy got the planetary engineer who got an award for the fjords of Norway. So I think that was a well-deserved award. So now with this trip going from the north to the middle of Norway or Trondheim on the boat was really a showing off the best of the nature. And I guess that also was probably intentional.
I also heard multiple times this is like the coolest conference / workshop that I've ever been to. I'm sure you did too, multiple times.
I think most of the people I talked to have said they really enjoyed themselves.
You just made the bar very high, so clear to go to other workshops, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, now, again, this is going to be at the start of the podcast. And now we're going to have sort of like the main material with like two. Well, first this, first one. Well, in this episode, we're going to have, one pair of, participants.
That's
and
right.
Then in the next episode, we're going to have the other pair of participants. And then, so after that, we sort of want to come back to you. And then so at the end of the second episode, to maybe think a little bit ahead.
Yeah, so through the magic of podcasting, let's get to the first episode and then we'll revisit Nico.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're on a boat in Norway, and we've Gaute and I have stolen you away to answer a few very broad, unfair questions, maybe,
Gaute? Really, really cool question. No, unfair. I don't think they're unfair.
Okay.
But that maybe you haven't sort of thought so much. I don't know. I think if I had to answer to these questions without having thought too much about it, I don't. Well, anyway, right. But you are better than I am, so. So well, that's fine.
Yeah. So, I mean, these are kind of broad questions. So one of the questions that we had for you both was how, in parentheses, has whether neuro AI, and we can talk about what neuro AI is, how has it changed the way that you ask questions or approach your scientific questions?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, but let's try and maybe first define.
So this is Andreas speaking. So
yeah,
you hear
yeah,
this is Greek, Andreas. Slight Greek accent, then it's Andreas.
Yeah, so for me, neuro AI is sort of defined in two ways. One is using the modern version of AI, which is deep learning with large data and large compute, to build models of the brain. And the way that I think it's impacting the research that we do, one way that is impacting it is essentially has changed our thinking of embracing high entropy data and then using the tools that have been developed to feed models.
What is high entropy data?
Well, meaning like, you sample, let's say, natural images without being very hypothesis driven.
Okay.
You just say, I'm just going to, or you do naturalistic behaviors and you record, you know, without like trying to like control the behavior a lot.
Exactly.
And basically, you know, and they build a lot of tools. A lot of them are engineering tools like GPUs, libraries, and, you know, different PyTorch and stuff like that enables us to feed this large scale data and basically use them as statistical ways to extract statistical structure from the data. So that's one way that it has it's been impacting us. The second way is that this field has been developing tools. Once you have a neural network that predicts something, you know, they are trying to develop tools to try and understand, get some interpretability, the whole field called mechanistic interpretability and how it works. And we're incorporating their tools. So these are the sort of more going from AI to neuro. On the other hand, of course, as neuroscientists, we're always interested to build intelligent systems That's a much harder thing, but it also has helped us think about what are the type of tasks that may be important and, you know, what is the advantages of brains versus AI, for example, this stuff about generalization, robustness, adversarial robustness. So I think it has been a fruitful interaction between AI and neuroscience.
But how can you contrast that with the way that you used to do science?
Yeah, it's very different because the way we used to do science, you know, we were always limited by data, both in terms of, you know, if you, let's say, wanted to record from a neurons in the brain, even if you could record from many neurons, you had, let's say, an hour or 2 hours to do an experiment, and you were, like, developing some hypothesis that you were testing. Whereas now it allows us to, like, control, you know, do more, like, non-hypothesis, more data-driven science. So it has changed from, I would say, hypothesis-driven science to data-driven science.
Yeah. Well, maybe, Ken, well, let's just ask you the same question if you have, because you have a different perspective on this, I think.
Yeah, so I'm a bit more old school, perhaps. So we certainly use AI technology, for example, to do video processing, the deep lab cut software and other things
as
like
that.
As a tool to let you do science by doing video processing that wouldn't have been possible a few years ago and that sort of thing, certainly. In terms of AI for informing scientific questions and conclusions, for me, I'm less up on the more, we certainly read stuff like what Andreas publishes using the most recent techniques. For me, the really valuable concepts at the moment are still those from a few years ago, such as kernel machines and variational Bayesian inference and things like these. We just use very fundamentally in the way we think about things.
So why do you stick with them? Because you understand them better?
Exactly, because these are the things that you can understand. Because a kernel machine, you know exactly what it is doing. You know how it works. A deep network, it's found a solution, but I don't really understand how it works. Maybe the point is that's the same with the brain. Maybe we're never going to understand how the brain works in the same way that we don't understand how a deep network works.
By the way, you guys interrupt each other and argue if you want to.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, there's pros and cons here. I mean, right now we're like basically putting a lot of emphasis on building a very accurate model of the brain in silico that's differentiable and stuff like that, that then we hope we can then analyze it to understand it. What Ken is saying, which is another approach, and of course it has other advantages, is like you start with a model that is already like built-in interpretability. So then if you feed the data, then the understanding falls out of it. Whereas the deep learning approach that is more data-driven, it's sort of you basically emphasize the predictability first, and then you hope that by looking inside the other thing is very good to compare the two, because if, for example, you use an interpretable model that only explains half of what the deep learning model does, it also says that there's really a lot that we don't understand.
Because I read some of your papers where in terms of where you train these deep networks to predict like this two-photon calcium responses to all these visual stimuli in mouse. And when you compare with the previous approaches with like Gabor filters and whatever, I mean, in terms of predictability, nothing compares to the predictability of these trained models. But that sort of maybe comes at the expense of being not quite sure how it works. And and maybe with the interpretability. So what's the interpretability of these, of your models, Ken? And these kernels.
Well, okay. Yeah. So the kernel is just a measure of similarity between how similarly a population of neurons responds to any pair of stimuli, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just a number for every pair of stimuli. Tells you how similar the population response is to those two stimuli. And there's a whole field of machine learning theory that went out of fashion about a decade ago that did a lot of very useful work in understanding what sort of representations those give you. And you can use all of that to understand what's going on in the neural code of the brain.
But I mean, so you know, you made the point earlier on, very early, that it's changed your science in terms of making it more data driven. I hear a lot that what we need is more theory. You know, with big compute, with big models as tools, with you know, with big data. So how do you think of that? I mean, are we in this? We're kind of in this weird space, right, where you have to explore to then generate theory, maybe even. I don't know how you think about
it. No, it is something that it sort of, I think a lot, and it bothers me in a way, but also, you know, it's like we are at this stage where the way we are doing sort of science and engineering with deep learning, it's a little bit non-classical scientific in that we figure a way, a hacky way, to basically build models that can drive cars around, but we don't really understand them in a classical scientific way, how they do it. We understand them to some extent. We understand the loss function. We understand something about the architecture of the network. But, you know, we don't have like an algorithmic understanding in a more classical way. And that is an issue. That's a problem. The question that I hope, and it's a hope, is that by building very highly predictive models, and that can generalize very well, I think generalization is key here, then the fact that they are differentiable, the fact that you have a model that you can do any experiment you want, that is actually a neural network, which is sort of like the brain, even if it's not implemented in the same way, but it still has synapses, synaptic weights, activities, then we just have to like develop tools, and the AI community is already doing that because they care about that too. And this is one of the issues about safety, and robustness and generalization, these are key things in AI, that then we can leverage what they're doing, what we develop, to try and gain some more understanding. And I think once we have that understanding, then it may be possible to then think about more interpretable models that are going to be simpler, that then will fit the data, and then we'll get to sort of bring it back to where what Ken is talking about.
Do you believe that, Ken?
I don't know. I mean, if you look in the history of science, there's some cases which are a lot of cause for optimism. So, for example, if you were an astronomer in the days of Tycho, but before Kepler, you might have thought there's no way all of this data is ever going to end up being simple. A few hundred years later, you have Newton's laws. You've got one equation that can explain everything. If you're a chemist, before the periodic table, you would never have guessed it was going to be that simple. On the other hand, if you were a biologist before the genome, you were then confronted with the fact that there's 20,000 genes and they're all different and you're never going to know what they all are. So we don't know for neuroscience whether...
But there's a difference, but those weren't complex systems. Right? I mean, like the DNA code readout is not a complex system. Whereas with brains, we're dealing with a complex system. Does that difference make a difference, do you think?
Well, the solar system is a pretty complex system.
It's complicated, but it's not a complex system. Well, I guess three-body problem.
What's the difference?
Well, complicated just means hard, lots of parts. Complex means interacting parts where there's emergent properties.
So it's sort of the stable. I mean, you can predict the planet, the orbit of Venus 500
years. Oh, you mean chaotic?
Yeah, chaotic. Yeah, I think it's complex systems are often chaotic, right? Or, well, not always. That's true. We are not chaotic completely. So, yeah,
of complex systems.
That's true. Anyway, yeah. Also, maybe that's...
But your point was things have looked impossible for over and over in the history of science, and maybe this is one of those things.
Things have looked impossible over and over. Sometimes they weren't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, so far, they still appear to be.
And we're in that regime.
Well, we don't know. Yeah. Right?
If I can come back to what you... I mean, you said, Andreas, that, I mean, now you're doing this like, training these deep networks, difficult to understand, and you hope to get the... that is or forms a basis for more interpretability. Yeah. So, and then, of course, we have better tools for understanding the whole... how the brain works. But at the moment, given what you sort of have at the present stage, has it sort of told you anything new about the brain or cognition that
No, I think that's a really good... I think it's still early to know if this is going to be, you know, if the way to the future is like, this is going to be like the standard. But there are cases where, for example, you know, this studying contextual modulation, you know, in the visual cortex.
Yeah.
I mean, people have been studying it with the gratings, and they found a specific relationship between center surround interactions. And then when we followed this image synthesis using these deep learning methods, we got something that was different. And the nice thing here is that then you can verify it back in the brain. You know, you can run this closed loop experiments. Mm,
that's so right. Inception loops, right? That you've been doing.
Yeah. So that's one example where it's not a circuit level mechanistic model, but the description of how the center and surround interact, we gain some new understanding that, you know, the other thing is like, once we do that, then you can design experiments in a more classical way, because now you develop the hypothesis, then to test it and then do exactly what Ken has been talking about. And in fact, we did build a model like that. You know, we built like a more Bayesian model that can try and explain center-surround interactions based on natural image statistics and priors.
In the primary visual cortex.
Yeah, in the primary visual cortex. So I think that's one example where you start with a data-driven model that there's no interpretability, it's just sort of an engineering task. Then you analyze it, then you derive a principle or some level of understanding, you test it back empirically to see if it's correct, and then you build a simpler model that is more based on more classical stuff, like in this case was hierarchical Bayesian inference, and say, can a model of hierarchical Bayesian inference trained on natural images predict, at least qualitatively, the same type of effect? You know, so I think that's an example.
You started your talk today with the clip of 60 Minutes of Hubel and Weasel serendipitously discovering the edge that, yeah. So they were moving a piece of paper, they were trying to test the visual neuronal response to dots, and they happened to move the transparency or whatever it was, yeah, off the screen. And part of that transparency, there was an edge where the transparency ended, right? And
yeah, then,
and that's how they discovered edge cells, right? Yes. And so this, and that's a data driven approach or an exploratory approach, but it was also serendipitous. And I was, it made me think right when you were starting that, are we past that stage where we're going to, like how does serendipity play a role these days? Ken, you're shaking your head.
All the time. Yeah. Almost everything we do is serendipity. You know, you get your data. Normally you have a hypothesis in mind, and when you get your data, you realize, oh, actually, wait, that was never going to work anyway. But then you notice something a bit odd in the data, and it's probably a bug. But you chase it up and, well, it doesn't seem to be a bug.
Yeah.
And then you follow it up a bit more, and then there's something you don't understand, and you don't understand why you would see this, and then you try and figure out why you're seeing it.
So it's the analog of, oh, who was the what's the famous quote when science progresses by saying, huh, that's funny.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does anyone remember who said that? I'll have to look it up later.
Mm.
Okay.
So, is there any way that, like, AI has set neuroscience back? I mean, or put some or many or all neuroscientists on the wrong track?
It's probably led to some blind alleys, but the problem is we don't know which ones they are yet.
And
we will in the future.
But do you think, so I worry that it in a lot of, especially young researchers' minds, might confuse the map with the territory, and that people, in terms of people thinking of the brain as a transformer, you know, and sort of substituting the model for the real thing. And then that conceptual framework then frames their research questions. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that has had a deleterious effect at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's early, it's still early to know where this thing is going to progress right now. But because there's also this kind of two-way interaction. Yeah. Some people are working, you know, it's like using tools from AI or as a model of the brain. I do think that there is some danger here of like basically just doing like using it as an engineering tool that is sort of the end game versus it's just the beginning of the end. So I do think it's important to like just see it as a tool right now and not take it It's just sort of like, okay, if I just take a model and I build it and it works great, I'm done. I should move on to something else. I think there is a little bit of that.
Yes, it's a lower threshold for starting doing it, right? I mean, to sort of, if you have tools like whatever, PyTorch, TensorFlow, you can sort of quite easily train networks to do something. So it's maybe it's sort of, you don't, I mean, if you do like traditional statistical analysis, it takes more effort to get into it maybe. And certainly compared to the physics type modeling, which is like the threshold for getting into it is more like basic tools. So this is, but I guess low threshold is both good and bad, right? I mean, it means that it's easier to test, but it's also easier maybe to do things which are not that high quality.
Is there a danger that it introduces less critical thinking from the beginning?
There is definitely that danger from AI in general, right? Like, I mean, it's sort of one of the, there are people that are trying to build, let's say, autonomous AI scientists to then analyze the data for you, right? I mean, I don't think it's going to happen around the corner, but there is...
It might replace me. It probably won't replace you.
No, I mean, but this is a niche, right? Like, it's easier to, but on the other hand, that's what, I think historically people were worried about when calculators came around, people were not... Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's important to just use it as a tool, but make sure that people are educated and they're doing the critical thinking.
Every new technology introduces new ways of doing things wrong.
And you don't think this is different at all in that respect?
No, not really.
No.
More is different, is the...
Well, it could get... It's easier to fool yourself when the thing trying to fool you can speak English.
Fluently.
Yeah.
Right.
That's true.
By the way, just as an aside, I have to commend you because you worked on a talk, and I think against your will, the talk that you gave, you really put thought into it and tried to address.
So the talk was on, what was the talk on?
The talk was on what would it mean for to say that a system such as a deep network is a good model for the brain.
Yeah.
And did that drive you crazy creating that talk?
Well, I thought at first I was going to say it's impossible and ended up after thinking about it, thinking that it could be possible. I don't think it's been done yet, but it's not actually impossible. But what it would need is an interventional experiment where you have a mapping between the artificial system and the brain that not only shows they have a similar representation of information, but also if you perturb them, you perturb the network, that causes a change in the rest of the activity in the network in a way that maps onto the way a perturbation of brain activity would. Mm-hmm. Then you can say there is a mechanistic similarity in how they're computing information, not just a similar representation.
But you also said that a model is something that shows what is not possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that fit in?
Oh, I think that's just what science is, right? Yeah. I mean,
falsifiability.
Yeah. Exactly.
Is there, I was trained as a physicist and there sort of but then there it was sort of looked a little bit down upon by active physicists to sort of talk about philosophy. It was sort of like this idea, shut up and calculate, right? That sort of...
They do it instinctively.
Yeah, but are we talking too little about these kind of questions? I mean, this kind of what does it mean to believe in the explanation? This is some sense have been our job for the last decades, right? To do science, which is about this. Still, it is sort of we don't really formulate it too often to ourselves, right? Or...
Yeah, well, that's why I was asking Andreas, too, if this is if we're in a weird space, because you have to explore with all these new tools.
I think we are in to me, we're in a more weird space than I've ever experienced. And I think, it feels like different, something qualitatively different than before.
Why do you say that?
Because I think the reason is because we are capable of building systems and models that seem quite intelligent, very intelligent, are capable, have capabilities. I bought a Tesla and I drive it and I'm really impressed by, it can drive for hours with, in a very complex environment and it's really impressive. you know, but then at the same time, you know, it's a neural network that nobody really understands in a classical scientific way. And I think that, and I do think it's a technological advancement of these two things. We have data, you know, we are in, I'm talking not just in neuroscience, but generally in biology, in medicine, in, you know, the way we, you know, have cameras everywhere, collect data, the internet, right? So we've created a society where we've made it easy to collect a lot of data. And then we have computers that became very fast, and we put these things together with neural networks, and we build all these very complex systems that are capable of doing complicated things, but yet we don't understand them. So, and I do think that, you know, there's some danger here, right?
So you're not talking about science specifically. You're talking about the state of the world.
I'm just talking about the state of, basically the whole, you know, if you look at, let's say, AI in general, and, I mean, and neuro AI is just neuroscience using AI. You can think of, let's say, the people that predict the stock market using AI, people that are trying to build, you know, autonomous driving. I mean, they were doing it before neural networks.
That's engineering.
Yeah, all these areas. Even in physics, they're using AI.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, Feynman and other physicists said that if I can't build it, I don't understand it. Or if I understand it, I can build it. I mean, it didn't mean like physically build it, but meaning make a physical model, physics type model that essentially gonna,
And now,
we're just sort of finished because now we put in these learning models and we, so we build things we don't understand.
Yes, exactly.
Which is sort of a new thing, right? And which is very fascinating. Yes. So now we have made this fantastic large language model just thinking about what it can achieve.
Yeah.
And we don't understand. And now it's like a research project. We just, we do research on it just like we do on a test animal, right? What does it really mean? Which is really fascinating. We built something, it's man-made, but we don't understand it.
Yeah.
And my impression is we went through that before, somewhat during the Industrial Revolution. People, the first steam engines were built without really understanding, let's say, thermodynamics. Yeah. And in fact, they were not safe. They used to blow up all the time. and it only became, after people started doing measurements, especially after, you know, discovering like low thermodynamics and temperature and pressure, things became so maybe we're going through that phase.
Well, at least we know that AI is safe and doesn't affect society. Exactly. That way, right?
Nobody worries about that.
No one worries about that.
Yeah. That's really interesting because the electromagnetism, there the revolution came after the like Faraday and Maxwell and like these people. So that's sort of, but it's true. The thermodynamics sort of came after the steam engine.
Yes.
They made things like entropy, this like term, and energy conservation and stuff.
So if we are in a weird space right now, just scientifically, then one of the questions that we were going to ask you was, you know, how long are we going to be in this space? Like, what role will AI still have a role in 50 years, or will we have used it to solve lots of brain problems? I'm not going to say solve the brain or solve intelligence, but will it have been a key factor, or is it a fad? Will it go away?
I'll tell you what I mean, I think about this a lot. I don't think I've never been in a situation in my life that I'm really curious what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years. Are we going to really have AGI that's going to basically like solve not just very difficult questions for the brain and neuroscience, but let's say health, I don't know, climate change, or is it going to be like the iPhone, right? When the first iPhone came, it was like amazing. Okay, now we have, I don't know, what is it, Model 13. It kind of looks similar, right? There's better apps, but is large language models and all these like things just a fad, as you said, and in 10 years, we're going to be like, yeah, you know. And in fact, in the last 2 years, I wouldn't say it's like impressively, amazingly getting much better, right? If you look at ChatGPT, I don't know, 3.5 versus 4.0, it's a little bit better. It does some things better. Or it's new applications. It can do video now. But it's not like, a qualitatively new type of thing. We're getting incremental changes. Now, that doesn't mean it will remain like that. But I think it's sort of very interesting because it's like, you know, and some days I wake up and I feel like, oh, my God, this is it. And others are like, not much is going to change. One thing is that this stuff relied a lot on the scaling laws. And I do believe that there's a big problem that these big companies are facing now. They're just running out of data to train their models.
So scaling in terms of like computers or data?
Both. The scaling law is both larger computers I mean, basically more energy and more data. But data, you know, they're synthesizing data, but it's a niche. Yeah.
A little bit incestuous.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the stuff they're doing now is like data selection, because there's a lot of, you know, they've shown that if you select the type of data you train, let's say a large language model or a video, it may make a big difference. But it does feel like to me that there could be things, let's say, in robotics with VR, people wearing cameras and collecting their body movements and imitation learning. But it's possible that we are sort of going to have incremental improvements, or maybe there will be a new revolution. I don't know. And I think that's going to impact us too.
Sure.
You know.
So I think you're right. Even if there isn't another step change, though, just the one we've already had.
Yeah, we don't even know how to deal with it yet.
It is creating a lot of changes to societies in ways that are going to be unpredictable, like the Industrial Revolution. So, for example, a friend of mine works in classical music. She has a lot of friends who are composers who used to write for film scores, and now they're at work.
Oh.
Because that's something that AI can do pretty well, is write classical music for film scores. And, you know, who would have predicted that? You know, and society's going to change in a lot of ways. There was, what was it called? There was something that had an AI girlfriend app. I think that's gone away.
Japanese thing, I think, that's popular.
Yeah. But there's all sorts of ways that society may really change that we just can't predict, even if there isn't another revolution.
Yes.
So if go back to the science, because I'm sort of doing sort of like physics type modeling, sort of a little bit in sort of like extension of Hodgkin-Huxley and like multi-compartment models and networks and so on. And it seems now that and computational neuroscience has always been like a small subfield of neuroscience. And now I also feel that maybe computational neuroscience is, because you have all this AI, I mean, if you want to go into computational neuroscience, maybe many people go into this using these AI tools. So that some sense is physics going to be like a traditional computational neuroscience? You know, I have this hope and maybe this idea that when you push this sort of learning roots and stuff, at some point to understand more, we have to get back to the biophysics of neurons and stuff.
It'll be important in the end. Yeah. Sure.
Just not.
This is an important point. What physical brain neurons do is so much more complicated than unit threshold ReLU units, right? And that's surely important.
For what, though? Maybe not to explain cognition. Maybe it's important for what question is it important?
Okay, if you took your brain and you replace every neuron with a ReLU unit, I would predict your cognition would be severely impacted.
Do I still get plasticity, though?
Yeah, okay. You just don't get any voltage-gated ion channels, no intrinsic oscillations.
My brain, again, might not be that different, but maybe yours would.
Yeah. I think that's an important point. The physical brain, for whatever reason, it has all these different cell types. The cells are very complicated. Maybe it didn't need to be like that to have an intelligent system. We don't know. But it is like that. And neuroscience, whose goal is to understand our brains rather than just to come up with an intelligent system, that stuff is going to matter.
But then isn't there a limit to the biophysical detail that you would need to implement? And can't you just figure out if there are 1,000 different types of neurons in the brain, give them 1,000 different activation functions and other algorithmic profiles, for example?
So you're saying you don't need to simulate every single channel.
What's the where is the bottom layer that matters?
I agree. I mean, I think this is a very interesting question, right? And I don't know the answer, but one possibility is the following, right? To really understand cognition and behavior, you really don't need to go down to, you know, the ion channels and the nonlinearities in the dendrites at that level, because it's just a bridge too far. It's too complicated. You know, just understanding it at the representational level and manipulating it, maybe, as you said, Ken, at that representational level, you know, so you have, let's say, an AI system that represents information, and you have the brain, and you study it at this representational level, and you manipulate them at this representational level, and you try and understand them. It's enough to build, to understand the science of intelligence or the laws of intelligence and build systems that are intelligent. And maybe they are computational neuroscience in a traditional way, maybe in trouble. But there is another way that is very important, which is diseases.
Yeah. Right?
In order to intervene, and maybe that's what Ken was saying, like in our brains, let's say, you know, psychiatric diseases, neurological diseases, they're not ralos. I mean, they have ion channels, they have molecular pathways, they have dendrites. You know, if you look at autism, the spines are different. And there is where maybe people that are doing more, let's call it physics-based or more classical biophysics, computational neuroscience, should maybe pivot in that direction. And that field probably needs people like computational neuroscience. And also that's where probably like, you know, most of, if you look at it, even from a practical point of view, where the funding is and what, let's say, NIH cares about is to cure diseases more than to really understand the algorithm of perception, right? So I do think there is an opportunity.
So I'm going to quote you in my next application.
Yeah.
Great Dr. Tolias.
But even those details, like, I think that's a good point about diseases and how that those lower level reductive small molecules, dendritic shapes and spine sizes, etc., matter at that scale. But then just like an artificial unit, if you can abstract what's important about how that affects communication, that might just solve it, right?
Yeah, you won't need to know every single potassium channel, but I think there will be, to make an accurate model of how the human brain works, you will need to incorporate things like dendritic nonlinearities and oscillations in some simplified form. That's what I would...
If you think, still we haven't really figured out what sort of mind or whatever conscious, I mean, this feeling of mind, which is different, that we are not only sort of looking at statistical relationships when we sort of infer things, right? We have this first person perspective. And so it's more to our intelligence than just sort of the things that are picked up by AI, I would think. So that's so saying that maybe you need these kind of things to.
Well, it's funny. I asked a large language model the same question that said the same thing.
Really? Did it say that they had a mind or that they didn't have a mind and we need to look at. We need a better brain model or something.
No, I'm just saying that the fact that you just said all of that.
Yeah.
Any agent could say that.
Yeah, but right. But you believe that I'm conscious, not you? I mean,
I don't know what that word means.
Really, conscious, but
oh no, let's not do it. Let's not do it.
Okay. One sentence on the topic of consciousness.
Yeah.
The moment that you actually define the word, it becomes quite a boring question.
Yeah. Mm. But I think it feels like something to be Ken. I think it feels like something to be me and Andreas and Paul. I'm not quite sure if it feels like something to be a large language model.
I don't think it feels like anything to be Ken. Just kidding, Ken.
No, that's correct.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, we went off to the off the consciousness.
Yeah, and we're at like 35 minutes.
Should we switch to, watch Twitch to what?
Well, I just don't want to take up everyone's time and everything. So
they have plenty of time. Don't worry. They are on the boat. Okay. Where should they go?
Okay, go for it.
Okay. No, I mean, sort of, we have one question. I just read this book called Slow Productivity. I think it's one of these. It's almost like the kind of book that you pick up at an airport. But it was sort of interesting in the sense that what does it mean to be need to be an efficient knowledge worker, which is different from being an efficient farmer or an efficient in because then you measure the output. And then sort of what does it mean? So I thought, what does it really mean? The book claimed that then since it's not easy to define knowledge, productivity of knowledge workers, you make these proxies. To sort of to look busy, sort of, you're in the, right? You work for a company and they sort of just look busy when the boss is coming, right? And maybe some of these things when you sort of look at sort of how we survive in science is like having many papers and is this, so this has sort of become a proxy for productivity, but not only numbers, but also the quality.
Let me just add also, like, especially in the neuro AI space, one way to look really productive is just to throw a neural network at whatever problem that you have without considering the theoretical framework or questions or hypotheses, right? So I just wanted to preface it.
I just want to add, I was thinking, what does it really mean? I haven't didn't think too much about it, but what does it mean to be productive in science?
Besides paper...
it's like these mundane things of surviving and funding grants and getting a job and...
Yeah, I think it's a problem. I mean, you know, there is, I mean, this is the way science is, right? It's like, it's not, you know, the way that I like to be justified is that, you know, we humans didn't really evolve to do science. We evolved to do other stuff. And science is something that we started doing in the last, I don't know, few hundred years, right? And it's kind of remarkable how much we've advanced science as humanity. So whatever we've been doing, even if it's like at any given point in time and at any one of us, it looks like it's very incremental and we're not doing much. You know, as a species, we've done tremendous advancement, right? So some ways why, you know, now, does it need improvement? I think it does. Right? Like, you know, and one of what you are saying is maybe the way our reward system is, or the classical academic system, may need to be reformatted to some extent. Like, some of these questions may require more teams working on it, where credit is, you know, it's not about just publishing the next paper, but it's more about, like, working on a project longer, maybe, you know, and allowing people to work as a team on a project longer and having a way to like reward them, yeah. You know, maybe allow some more risk.
But do you mean, you know, personally productive?
Or? Yeah, I know, just because, I mean, I understand people who don't have permanent jobs and want a permanent job, that's like a different thing, right? Or, but I'm sort of like a professor with a permanent job, yeah. So I can in principle do anything I want, but that's still, you sort of, as a professor, when you sort of, you easily get involved in too many projects, yeah. Because you don't sort of want to be, it feels good in some sense, if I'm doing this as well.
You get roped into podcast conversations.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, it's sort of this thing.
There's a bit of a danger in that.
Yeah, I think it's just something that my own sort of, the psychology of people makes us be very stressed sometimes, and often the, you end up, Ken is breathing here, right? And often when you have several PhD students and you have some feeling of responsibility, you have maybe have to spend most time on the project which is working the least. So you have to sort of to try to salvage it, right? So sometimes think, I would much rather work on the thing that this person is doing because that's, oh, great. So it's just something about psychology of how we make choices.
The best thing for my productivity was when I formed a team lab with Matteo Carandini. Mm. And there's just something about that, you know, when you've got two people, I might have an idea, I think it's great, but then he says, wait, but did you think X? Mm. You know, and then you save so much time just by that. I mean, you have a lot of collaborations as well.
Andrew, yeah, so yeah, a lot. Yeah.
Similar thing. Yes.
But do you also feel the responsibility to be productive for the other person? I mean, do you feel a... Does having a collaboration make you more likely to do the work you need to do the work?
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, you feel because like, there's someone to remind you, hey.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, didn't you say you were going to... oh, yeah. Yeah.
So put your self-worth in someone else's hands.
But doesn't that mean that you sort of sometimes are just getting stressed and not able to think?
Well...
When was
life not like that?
No, exactly. But it's inoperable. I mean, that's sort of that.
Well, there's the Dodds-Yerkes curve. Is that right?
But I heard, for example, and then Francis Crick, obviously, he was after he sort of like, after he sorted out the DNA and also like this, whatever the other proteins and according, exactly. Then he sort of, after it, and he wanted to stay under busy. So the thing that I think he just wanted to have so few projects that he could always jump on something which was really exciting, right? Of course, then he's sort of in a position where he can sort of like, you don't have any social constraints or practical constraints, but it's this thing that, I don't know. I've been thinking about that lately, sort of what is sort of external pressure and what is just internalized that we make silly choices because we are just internalized kind of behavior.
We surely do, but the moment you try and come up with how to change the system, I mean, the things you're saying about these changes in incentives, it's all good, but these are minor, this is all fairly minor changes, right? The system isn't perfectly efficient, but when you try and think how to make it better, it's quite hard to come up with anything radically different.
Absolutely. So this is not what I'm more thinking that even people who are, but people should maybe like when people have like a Nobel Prize, they can sort of
for example, and try to be under.
I said that to you.
Really?
Yeah, I said, well, he was like, for the Crick example, he's already famous. He can do what he wants. That's true.
But I mean, I can do. I'm not. But I can do what I want also. I think that many people at some stage in their career.
There's loads of examples. So Maxwell, the physicist.
James Clerk.
Yeah.
James Clerk.
Spent something like 20 years trying to find a particulate explanation of electromagnetism.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
Yeah. No. You know. There's so many cases, but you know, you don't know what's the blind alley.
But what would happen if you sort of decided to, now we're going to solve some kind of, just focus on one particular mathematical problem related to neuroscience analysis? Would you wouldn't be fired, right? Would you, or I don't?
I'd have a conversation with my boss at some point.
Yeah,
she'd kind of say, you know, you used to get a lot of groans.
Exactly. What about you, Andras? We have actually changed. You just moved to Stanford, so you're trying to make a good impression.
Same. I mean, we can do whatever we want, but you know, if you keep, I mean, especially in the US, the system is very competitive. Mm. I mean, it's true everywhere, but I'm saying it is a little bit like running a little startup in the especially in medical school. So you have to bring in resources, But I do also think it, you know, what you said about Krieg is interesting, right? Because, you know, I think we're still at the stage where, you know, I mean, obviously the most important thing is to choose the right question, but it's not clear like there's like, this is the question, right? There's always like a lot of possibilities. Mm-hmm. So we try and sort of, you have to remain focused, but also remain open-minded enough to see where new things may be happening.
Here's a different way to ask the question. What makes you feel unproductive?
Web surfing.
Web surfing? Okay. I mean in science, not like doing it. And you cannot answer this conversation. Yeah.
No, I think, sometimes, you can be unproductive, it's hard to know, sometimes you feel you're unproductive because you're like sort of you're daydreaming or you're like...
unproductive? All right, a year goes by and you feel either it was a productive or an unproductive year. What do you think made it productive or unproductive?
I think it's more, it's complicated, right? Yeah, there could be years where, you may not be publishing as much. But, you feel you're very productive because you're doing new experiments, you have new
results.
You're
laying the groundwork.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say, there is a metric,
I've spent a lot of time over the last few years on statistical methods that a few of them I've written preprints. Not one of them has been, I've even submitted a peer-reviewed paper.
Okay.
But I do think it was worth it. And maybe I'm at that stage now. I can do what I want. So I've spent a lot of time on these questions of statistical analysis.
Then it seems like you actually educated yourself also.
Right? Oh yeah, absolutely. But
that's, I think for me, an unproductive project would be something I just join, even though I'm not particularly interested, not particularly challenging, but it has some reward in terms of maybe in getting on a publication. So you spend your mental resources on the
things you don't really find interesting.
And it's not really building up to anything. I don't really need a new AI for tax laws or whatever.
Actual project.
Really? I don't know. No, this is not an actual project, but I was thinking example of something which is important, but not really. So,
Dr.
Paul?
Let's just move on then and ask perhaps the closing question. By the way, the quote was, it's from Isaac Asimov. And I did use ChatGPT to look this up, so hopefully it's correct. The most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not Eureka, but that's funny. That's the quote.
Yeah.
Isaac Asimov. I'm glad I didn't say Einstein because
we sort of prepared yesterday. And this question of sort of, I've been thinking of this question of if for some reason there was a moratorium, it was almost like the pandemic, where you couldn't do experiments for a year, so that everybody had to sort of work on existing data. And Because would that be a good thing? Because now I have a feeling that it's sort of, it's all these things that you measured and you don't really understand it. So, oh, let's put in another mouse.
Can I go beyond that and say that you weren't even allowed to analyze existing data? All you could do is read their literature.
Yeah. You got shut down that much. I mean, that's why everyone, like 90% of neuroscientists wrote their first books during the pandemic, right? There's a bunch of books.
Okay, so exactly. So would it be a good thing? I mean, I don't want to live in a society where this is happening. But
if all I could do was read papers, I'd be very happy.
Yeah.
For how long, though?
Oh,
a year. Forever.
I mean, yeah, I don't need to write anything.
But don't you want to do the science? You just want to read and learn?
I think, so you talked about Francis Crick. That's basically what he did in neuroscience. He just read papers, and he tried to figure things out, and then he wrote
a book.
He wrote a book, he wrote review articles, he, but that's all he did. Right? It was very valuable.
Mm.
It is. No, it's true.
Yeah.
I think different people, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we need to do more experiments. You know,
I'm more thinking about the moratorium to think about what we have and then.
Yeah, I think thinking, you know, stopping and thinking about things, I think is very, very important.
I mean, none of us do it, really.
But it's easier. It's so much easier to do the next experiment than to think.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's also when I do simulations and I change parameters and it doesn't really work. And then let's try another parameter set because it makes me feel that I'm doing something. While actually I'm just sort of trying to avoid to think.
So we shouldn't have another COVID? Is that the take home? Or we should?
Yeah.
I don't think we should.
No.
But I do think that it's important to think. I think there's a lot of pressure to keep, you know, stay in the rat race. But I think figuring ways to get outside the rat race and think, it's always important.
Yeah.
I have maybe a quick question before our last question, if you guys have a few more minutes. How do you know when you have a good idea scientifically? Like, how do you, when you kind of feel like, all right, this is a good idea, without much vetting of the idea?
Before you ask your science experimental collaborator.
No, you just know.
Is it just an intuition?
Yeah,
but don't you have those intuitions that turn out to be bad ideas?
Oh, yeah, lots of times. Yeah.
Then how do you know? How do you decipher if you...
Well, you wake up. You know, they normally come in the middle of the night.
Right, or in the shower or...
Yeah, and then if you still think so that afternoon, that's pretty good sign.
Okay.
I agree. Something, you know... You know, sometimes, you think you have a great idea and then you think more about it and then... Yeah.
Isn't that the best feeling in the world, though? Like, when that thing hits you and you're like,
But I have had this great business idea in the middle of the night, and we woke up and I had to write this down because I looked at it in the morning. It was just
that's good.
Completely ridiculous. Yeah. But it was I felt so in the middle at 4 o'clock, 4 a.m.
But that's good because you could falsify it because I fail to write mine down all the time, and then it goes off, and I think I still come up with good ideas, but who knows?
Exactly,
I've forgotten them.
No. So mine was not very good.
Yeah. So intuition.
Intuition is key. Yeah.
Okay.
So the last one. So there's like the advice to young researchers.
This is Gauta's question because I've stopped asking this on my
okay.
podcast.
Okay. Yeah, so then it's the.
I'll include it for sure.
Yeah.
I like the question.
Yeah. No, I mean this. You are sort of very established researchers. And so what would you sort of what is the advice to?
My advice is. Especially, I think this is generally true, is to young researchers is spend a lot of time thinking about what is the question that you really want to address and talk to a lot of people, you know, like don't just like do it just because you want to get some training, you know, just sort of focus on the question more and it's okay to kind of explore stuff and be thirsty sort of for a good question. You know, and I often find like people are being too like practical and like jumping into a project and then, you know, kind of you're going to get training, I'm going to do this. But I think it's very important because one thing that I didn't, you know, my experience, but also this is true in the history of science, it doesn't matter how motivated you are or how much hard work you put. Of course, these are important. But often, Francis Crick is a perfect example with the double helix, right? It wasn't in their project. But, you know, it was a good question they worked on. He did an amazing discovery. So, and I do think that, you know, we kind of maybe don't spend enough time, you know, and this is something we don't get trained as undergraduates, you know, or in high school. Like, we don't think, okay, what's a good question? Like, we're just taught facts. And then suddenly when you start doing research, now you have to start thinking about questions. And it's a hard thing to do. And I would say for young people, spend more time thinking about what is really the question that I want to do. So this is one thing. Unless you innately have something that you're very excited about, you're very curious about, that's the best thing of a scientist. Like, if there's something that you're very curious about, just follow your curiosity and what really excites you. Mm. But if you're trying to choose, you know, you say you want to do a, you don't become a scientist, and you're trying to say, okay, what should I work on? Mm. You know, I'm excited about a lot of stuff, or I can get excited about a lot of stuff. Spend a lot of time thinking about the question.
Mm. Would you, just linking that back to that productivity question, would you consider that productive?
Yeah, I would see, think of that as very productive, even if it looks like you're not doing anything for...
That's valuable. I think that was valuable.
A month or a year or a couple of years. I think because, you know, it's like a big boat, right? Once it takes off and goes into a direction, it's harder to steer it, you know. So at least it's important. Unless you have like some thing that is like, okay, I'm very curious, I don't know, about, you know, some problem in physics, or I don't know, like people are just curious about something. Yeah. They can't sleep, they stay up at night thinking about it, then go for that, you know. Yeah. But if it's like, you know, you're trying to get a PhD and you're interested, let's say, in neuroscience or molecular biology or genetics, you know, there's so many stuff, there's so many labs, just put effort thinking about what is the question and where, you know, and educate yourself more broadly. Don't just, you know, go very narrow. You're going to have to go narrow and focus for sure. But start broad. Like, what is the impact of what I'm trying to do? Where is this field going? You know, I think it's important. But
yeah. So what I'd say is you have to enjoy it. And if you're not enjoying it, switch to doing something else that you do enjoy.
Do you have to enjoy it 24/7?
No, but on balance, it has to seem worth it. And if you ever think, why am I doing this? Then think, how can I change it so I actually want to do it? And if you can't change it so you want to do it, then do something else. Because, like, there are other options. And if you're not at the point of science is you're supposed to enjoy it. So if you're not enjoying it and you can't figure out how to enjoy it, then do something else.
But I guess also there is some, I mean, obviously you are sort of successful. It's sort of like a survivor bias because you actually, well, at least you made it to get a...
So far.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I guess people, like young people listening to this, they think, well, I enjoy it, but what's the, and if I want to, I enjoy being like doing research, maybe get a position in academia or at a research institution doing basic research. But what are my chances for actually making it? I mean, this is always that thing also, right? I mean, investing many years
in but it's not like you can't do something else. No. I mean, so, you know, it, for me, I very nearly stopped
at a certain point. Tell us more.
Tell your story. You have a quite unusual story.
So my... yeah, very unusual. So my PhD, I started doing physics, switched during my PhD, which funded me to do anything I wanted anywhere in the world. So I thought about all sorts of things. And
that's a nice scholarship.
I know, it was great. It was the fine print. Lots of American citizens have this. They just don't know they have it.
Okay.
So I ended up doing kind of neuro robotics in London, and you know, it wasn't that much of a success, my PhD really, but
your bachelor was in mathematics.
It was in math. Because the lab I was in didn't have any continuation of funding, I had to fund myself. So I got a job building a very early internet gambling website. very easily could have stayed doing that. It's only a few years ago, actually, that I finally earned more money than I was in that job.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there's always other options.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much everyone doing this job can code.
Yeah.
You know, you have other options.
Yeah.
I could have been a stay-at-home dad. That would have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think, I'm like, at least when my students ask me about this, I say, well, taking a PhD and you're sort of learning how to, like, scientific programming, coding and stuff, that's always going to be good. I wouldn't worry about that. It's more maybe if you decide to go on postdocs, then you are sort of, that's more of a bifurcation point.
It cuts you off. Do you think it cuts you off? I don't think so.
I don't really know.
I've had postdocs go and work in data science. They've done great.
Yeah. And they even got good jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Great. Maybe I'm too pessimistic.
Maybe.
Hmm.
Thank you, guys. Is there anything else?
Yeah.
No, appreciate it. Great. By the way, Christina, are you? First of all, you're cheating by being in this room. Secondly,
it was purposefully done.
Yes. Oh, so you're not waiting for us, right?
No.
Okay. I just realized.
Oh, yeah. Because Tom is out. Tim is out hiking.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just. I thought.
Now you know what we said. You can see the rest.
Yes. That's good. You stole my thunder.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Great.
Brain Inspired is powered by The Transmitter, an online publication that aims to deliver useful information, insights, and tools to build bridges across neuroscience and advanced research. Visit thetransmitter.org to explore the latest neuroscience news and perspectives written by journalists and scientists. If you value Brain Inspired, support it through Patreon to access full-length episodes, join our Discord community, and even influence who I invite to the podcast. Go to braininspired.co to learn more. The music you're hearing is Little Wing, performed by Kyle Donovan. Thank you for your support. See you next time.